Greetings, ladies and gentlemen. Now listen, you're listening to the Castilbras podcast with a K. Don't worry about other podcasts. Let them gawp, let them gape. Yes, did you know that we're available on Castilbras.com, iTunes, Stitcher.com and Audioboo? Well, you do now. Good, isn't it?
Ladies and gentlemen, my name is Christian Corley. You have found yourself listening to the podcast with a K. You may have downloaded it, which is extremely silly of you, or you may be streaming it in your browser by accidentally clicking that little play button, thinking that actually you were wanting to click on one of the adverts that you've seen on the internet. No,
idiot.
Sorry, you're actually listening to myself, Brian Terranova.
Hello.
And James McLean.
Hi.
He's the one who just called you an idiot, but yeah. I suspect that, like you, he was talking about himself. And this is the Castilbras podcast with a K. And now that's a little bit. I built that bit up there as if we used to put when we used to put the theme tune in there, didn't I? But nowadays, dear listener, we have the voice of the Doctor at the beginning of the podcast. So I don't really need to do that. So I'm not really sure why I did. So there you go. It's been a funny old week in Doctor Who. I think you'll agree. Chaps,
will we?
Yeah, because
yes.
Although there's been no actual Doctor Who on the telly, been no Doctor on telly. I'll tell you, bam, sick me. There has been no Doctor Who broadcast on television in the past week. However, there have been a few interesting snippets in the news. Which before we move on to our main feature, I thought we might have a brief chat about one or two of them. How does that fit with your worldviews, chaps?
I think it's different. Go on.
Okay.
What's he talking about?
I have no idea.
Oh, I don't know.
Okay. So, what I wanted to talk to you about was the some of the recent articles on Castilbras. There's some interesting chats on Castilbras. I don't know if you know about this. And I wondered what you thought. Oh, well, first of all, there is... you guys won't know about this, but I've reviewed Contradiction.
Oh, okay.
The game upon within which Mr. John Guiler, who you may have heard earlier, dear listener, Paul Darrow and Rupert Booth. There's no lightly fried potato-based snacks in the game, as far as I can recall. Although there is a pub, so maybe there's some in the background. And it's a lovely
ginger
game.
Ginger nuts.
Is that what it is? It's a ginger nut, is it? Okay. And Rupert Booth, who appeared on the podcast before Christmas, he's also in Contradiction. So I've finally logged my review on Castilbras. I was trying to get to the end of the game. We're at 96%. And after a kind of a 10-day hiatus at the 46% area, we made good progress over the weekend, but ran into another wall. So I decided I was going to get my review up there for the first time for people to read. I've done a review. And also, what's interesting is I've also used this little box, which we don't use very often. We've never used it before. And the K in the Castilbras has found its way into the term the score. So it's a score with a K for a Contradiction of 88%. And just as a brief summary, I declared it. Unmissable, affordable iPad game with superb performances, involving storyline and great direction. And that last bit is key for an interactive movie. Doctor Who and Blake's Seven fans will be thrilled by the casting alone. And so if you haven't played it yet, or you don't have an iPad, don't worry, because there's a version coming out on PC through Steam and for Amazon Fire TV in the near future. So I'm hoping once those other two versions are released, we get to speak to John and perhaps one of his co-stars that we haven't already spoken to. But at least John, perhaps. So, that'd be interesting to get John Guiler back on. And, guys, what sort of weekend have you had?
Cold one.
Yeah?
Yeah. Cold one. Nice, though, I guess.
Okay. My aunt in Canada, she reported it was minus 40 wind chill.
Oof. Yeah, she's got to be a little worse off than where I am, that's for sure.
Yeah,
I say a little, but I mean a lot.
Okay. And how about you, McLean?
Ginger nuts.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay.
I don't actually really. They're not very nice.
Are they McCurdy's ginger nuts?
I wouldn't want to brand them.
Are they a supermarket brand?
Maybe, sort of.
Okay. I find ginger biscuits to be quite generally disappointing these days, unless they're kind of, you know, made by a smaller provider of such snacks.
I find the same with Neighbours. Same sort of feeling.
The TV show or?
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah, can be very disappointing.
Okay. Are you watching Neighbours at the moment, James?
No, I'm not.
All right.
I was glancing through a textbook rather than listening to you, but I am now listening to you quite seriously.
What textbook is it?
It's a book by, it's a chapter on genre.
Okay.
Genre theory.
Okay.
Which is by Rick Altman. Anyway, now what did I do this weekend? Not very much, really.
Was there a convention in your neck of the woods at the weekend?
My neck of the woods? Yeah. No, they're probably in his.
What about you, Brian?
He stalks them.
There was one in Baltimore, and I used to go to it each year, but I actually haven't gone the past 2 years. It's a good convention. It was. It's called KatsuCon.
But nice.
When I say it's a good convention, it's an anime convention. So, like, in all honesty, the subject matter of it doesn't really interest me. But there's a huge Doctor Who following that goes. So there's always something fun to do. Always new people
to
meet.
LA?
You know what? I think what it was in the beginning when Doctor Who started becoming big again over here, or big with the new series, I guess I should say. They didn't have a home. Really. I mean, there was Chicago and there was L.A. So, yes, they were a little bit difficult to get to because those were always running, Chicago TARDIS and Gallifrey One. But locally, there really wasn't that much. And even local Comic-Cons, I guess local Comic-Cons also became a thing for them as well. But somehow the anime conventions had a lot of a Doctor Who following. And I'm not sure why the two crossed, maybe because they were from overseas, both of them. But yeah, it was a very nice convention because the venue was really just a gorgeous hotel convention center, really nice for photo shoots, and really just a nice time, a nice place to spend your time. It was one of the better it's one of the better convention venues I've ever been to.
Okay,
but you didn't go to it.
I didn't go. I've been cutting back a little bit on the conventions that I'm doing for a couple of different reasons. So I'm limiting myself to a few various ones. And while I really do enjoy this one, I decided to kind of make a bit more of a focus on going places where the subject matter is also a bit more to my interest as well, because this way I feel like my money is being a little bit more well spent on my part, kind of thing.
Okay.
Yeah. Well, you know, I'm not into anime. I'm not into
one was judging you there. I was trying to move it on.
Yeah.
I was ending.
Oh, I see.
Yeah. Don't worry.
You should have just done an odd segue there.
Well, you both slagged me off behind my back when I was doing an odd segue, so
I kind of stopped doing it.
Go on. Give us one.
I can't really do from that to that, I suppose. That would be quite tough. Other than to mention that, obviously, Gallifrey, the massive Doctor Who convention, took place over the past weekend, and none of us went, so there you go.
None of us went, but I'll tell you, my friend Bob and his friends spent a lot of time making their Davros costume and chair, and the thing really looked great. But the one thing that I'm always jealous about with Bob being at Gallifrey 1 is that guy gets photos with every celebrity that goes to the cons. And obviously he got his photo this weekend with Terry Malloy because he was there. And that's just an op you can't miss.
Yeah.
But, you know, one year he was there and Matt Smith and Karen Gillan were there. And they love costumers. They love the whole cosplay thing. Like it apparently wasn't as big in the UK originally, whereas now I guess it is from all the people I know over there who do it. But they had fun just driving around L.A. during the convention, spotting all the cosplayers on the street. Well, at the convention, and this was maybe 2-3 years ago now, maybe a little bit longer than that, they actually sought out Bob and friends for a photo rather than the other way around.
Right.
That makes me so jealous.
Yeah.
Like, I have to seek out these celebrities.
It's a very poor quality in a man.
I think
it's very interesting because it shows how, because the two of them are quite young,
yeah,
how they are grafted into the same sort of social media and the same sort of mentality in self-representation as the fans are. So you can sort of understand why they would want to go and find a certain people to have a photo done, because photos now have a sort of more of a of-the-moment appeal. It's interesting in that sort of respect. I wouldn't imagine Peter Capaldi. I probably could imagine Peter Capaldi rushing around looking to find someone for a photo, but
not
someone of an older
Eccleston.
Generation. Yeah, Christopher Eccleston.
But then you wouldn't find him at convention either. So.
Yeah, you'd have to have him. Yeah, that would particularly be a very interesting. That could almost be a film, because there's that. It was Tom Hanks, wasn't it? The film where he's in the airport and he can't get out. It's all set in the airport, and you could do one with Christopher Eccleston stuck in a convention.
No. Because
desperately trying to
Gallifrey takes place at an airport.
At LAX, actually, it was perfect,
that
isn't
is
it?
Perfect,
yeah.
James.
It is, isn't it? You could do a wonderful parody of both that sort of film and of science fiction culture with Christopher Eccleston, and he'd probably take part in something like that. Because
I would love to see that
parody.
Now.
So would I.
If I write this?
Only if you're going to pay me some sort of.
Well, I'm probably not going to pay you myself, but someone might.
That'd be good. Go for it. I think that's a good idea. Go on, Chris. So what
dear
did
listener,
you want?
Dear listener, this is just between us, okay? So you're hearing Genesis, but this is ours.
Balls. All right. Yeah. Right, well, if it goes online, we've got evidence of when it was. We can timestamp it, isn't it?
Absolutely.
Brilliant.
Oh, that's brilliant. Yeah, well done. So anyway, a guy who did like going to conventions in the United States was Mr. John Pertwee.
Okay.
Thank
Let's
you.
See where this is going.
Very good. Very good.
And do you know, it's 1974, wasn't it? So it's 41 years since his last series on Doctor Who. Which commenced with The Time Warrior, which is one of those strange stories which always ends up in the sort of the middle of the rankings of Doctor Who fans. Some Doctor Who fans don't like it that much, maybe slightly tempered by the old Omnibus edition that was on the original VHS, a bit like what we were talking about with the Blake 7 last week, isn't it, James?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And other Doctor Who fans like it a lot. And it obviously introduced the Sontarans. There's... written by Robert Holmes. It's got some good guest cast. It's got some not so good guest cast, and it's a kind of it's one of those very few historical romps from that era, set in Earth's past. But of course, it does have the alien intervention, so it does kind of solidify that, cement that sort of area of Doctor Who's regular sort of going into the past tropes of sticking an alien in there rather than just sort of letting things go. When was the last time the Doctor went into the past and there wasn't an alien there? Was it Black Orchid?
Yeah.
Blimey.
Yeah, right, yeah.
So the three of us have all watched...
Before that, was it the Highlanders?
Could well have
been. Very early on.
Yeah. So the three of us have enjoyed the Time Warrior in the past fortnight, haven't we, guys?
We have. Well, I have, James.
Yep. So have I.
Yeah. Let's segue over this bit.
When did you last watch The Time Warrior?
Oh, well, I don't know. It was probably, I don't know, about 1993, 95 maybe.
Okay. Do you know, in a strange echoing of the last time we did this, I didn't actually watch all of The Time Warrior.
Oh, yes. You've got no professionality.
I just realised I've only watched three episodes because because we've been playing Contradiction, I've been watching Blake 7, and there is a... basically, we've discovered that we can watch movies on the iPad through the Apple TV on the telly.
The listener doesn't care. The listener
So we've been watching. We've been watching movies, basically. So I've only watched three episodes of Time Warrior, but that's not so bad because I last watched The Time Warrior like last year, so unlike you.
But like you were saying earlier, because it was one of the very early VHS releases,
yeah,
it's one that I watched quite So I it's very, very much embedded, while Time Lash wasn't.
Yeah,
Time
yeah, Lash sure, sure.
Isn't, but this absolutely. I know too well, unfortunately.
Let's go to Brian. Brian, I'm interested to know how you first discovered the Time Warrior.
Well, do you know, I think the Time Warrior was actually one of the very last Doctor Who stories I've ever watched. You know, for me, it was PBS or VHS at the time. And at the end, when Doctor Who started making the changeover to DVD, they decided to go ahead here, anyway, I believe they did it in the UK as well, but to complete the VHS collection with the, quote, End of the Universe box set. And if I'm not mistaken, the Time Warrior was one of those in the VHS box set of the End of the Universe. And at the time, Pertwee was one of the last Doctors that I had watched. For some reason, I had it in my mind I wasn't going to like this guy. And it was such a silly thing, you know, such a stupid thing, just looking at the costume and whatnot. And it turned out I loved him. But yeah, the Time Warrior, if I remember correctly, it was in that box set. And it was probably the last Pertwee episode I've ever seen.
Okay. So,
or rather, the last new Pertwee to me episode I've ever seen.
Okay. Now... I'm interested, when you watch Doctor Who, just not just Time Warrior, but anything, when you were watching Doctor Who in the USA, was it in episodic format, or was it in, you know, all-in-one feature-length format?
It depended on which channel you were watching it on. When I was growing up, it's so tough to say. When I was growing up, I could have swore it was in episodic format, just because of how much I remembered watching that theme tune. But certainly when I found it again in high school, one channel was doing the feature length episodes, and remembered actually thinking Doctor Who was just aired that way until another channel, because a couple local PBS channels, and they all kind of are a little bit far reaching. My local one in Philadelphia was doing the feature length, and the other one from, I guess it's Wilmington, Delaware, was transmitting here as well. And also NJN, the New Jersey network, that one was transmitting here as well. And I think they both had the episodic, which is where I first kind of discovered it before I started buying the VHSs, that it was episodic. So it all depended on what channel you got and I guess what kind of transmittable copies that they had purchased.
Okay. Now, the Time Warrior for me...
But it's weird. Childhood, I don't know.
Okay.
Go on.
The Time Warrior for me was... It was... There wasn't very many of them. There's maybe 5 to 10 at the most VHSs released in the late 80s, early 90s, which were in this kind of feature-length format. Now, I first saw the Time Warrior. I can tell exactly when it was. It was 1994 when I got it on VHS because I was... This may surprise you. I was working as a sort of labourer for a short time when I finished college, and I was paid pennies for about 2 weeks' work. I probably earned about 50 quid, and I spent 20 to 30 of that on Doctor Who videos in W.H. Smith, one of which was The Time Warrior, which was reduced, thankfully, because it'd been out for a few years at that point. And another one was The Spearhead from Space version that was released for £7, I think. There was a range of 4 or 5 that were released for just £7 in their proper episodic format. So I picked up a collection of Doctor Who's, and one of them was a Time Warrior. And I enjoyed it, but the feature length aspect of it did annoy me slightly, because being a big fan of the Doctor Who theme tune was, it's a big part of watching Doctor Who, isn't it, on DVD or video. James, how did you discover the Time Warrior?
I'm trying to remember. I mean, it was similar to you, except I wasn't a labourer or anything like that.
When I finished college, it wasn't like a...
It doesn't matter. Once you've gone down that path, you're stained forever. I am, of course, joking.
You, dear listener.
Do you think so? I'm sure there's no labourers listening to this. They'll be listening to the radio on their builder sites with their shovels. I can't remember quite genuinely when it was. I remember it was one of the first ones. It was the Ginger Nut. I remember having this similar issue as you had, with the edited format. That really bugged me. Mm-hmm. I think of all those original VHS ones, I think it was probably one of the more mundane ones, possibly one of the more childish ones. Uh-huh. I think the Poe era did sort of descend a lot more than classic golden era righteous fans like to admit into that sort of childish area. There were times where it lost its maturity, and I kind of felt the Time Warrior was one of them. Mm. So, yeah, I don't think it's Onibus sort of style edit did it any justice. I think it's probably a lot better to watch in sections and a lot more enjoyable because there is a bit of back and forth thing in that show. I think the other thing is it sets up quite nicely. The first episode in the think tank is quite enjoyable, and the medieval bits is a bit mundane, really. It's a bit BBC costume drama.
It is a bit panto,
yes.
The medieval bit, isn't it?
It is, and Sarah Jane Smith's role in it is quite panto as well.
Yeah, she is. She's the boyish girl in panto, isn't she? Really, in many ways. In that, I wonder. Really, it's not really the best introduction for her, is it? Really, I don't think, because she proves herself to be a bit of a fool who's easily led in completely the wrong direction, and you know it shows that she does kind of throw herself into what she's doing, but she does make a bit of a fool of herself, which isn't the best way to introduce a companion, I don't think.
I didn't think it was that bad. I mean, I like the fact that she was gutsy enough to go ahead and pretend to be her aunt, sneak into the think tank for her story, and then when she found herself into the past, you know, she had no idea time travel was even happening at that point. You know, she just found herself there, so I think it was reasonable to assume at first that somehow it was a joke being played. But I actually liked the concept that she thought the doctor was the bad guy.
Yeah.
Rather than coming in and going, oh, well, you know, immediately doing like a Joe Grant where this guy's the hero and I have to be by his side. I like the fact that at first she's like, it's got to be him. You know, it's his box here. It's him. It's together. And I thought that was a very neat introduction, because rather than coming in as the instant friend, she had a little barrier to overcome before she realized she could trust this guy.
Yeah. OK. I'm just looking at the cast list for the Time Warrior, and I notice... I'll just remind myself of the moment when Link suddenly starts talking Australian for no reason. and I mean, it doesn't go on too long, but one could exaggerate and say he's a breath away from calling everyone Bruce. Or Sheila. David Dacre's really good in it. He's been in a couple of Doctor Who's, hasn't he? He was in the Varaxian one, wasn't he, as a captain of the liner. That was David Dacre, wasn't it? In Nightmare on Eden.
Oh, was it?
Pretty sure it was.
Yeah, you know, I just looked him up too Yes, it was Nightmare on Eden.
Yeah.
Because when I was watching it, I knew his face and his voice was familiar, so I looked it up and I just couldn't remember what it was.
And obviously there's June Brown in there. Brian, you won't know this. June Brown, well, you may. But June Brown's kind of television royalty in some circles.
Really?
Yeah, because she's been a cast member of EastEnders almost permanently since it started in 30 years ago this year, where she plays a mad character called Doc Cotton, who's a devout Christian who smokes and has a criminal son. And, you know, every 10 years or so, they recycle the same storylines about him having a heroin addiction, and she has to go and buy some heroin for him.
Yeah,
they're in the middle of one of those at the moment. You might be interested to know, dear listener. Jeremy Bullock, who's... Hal the Archer in there, of course, is well known with Star Wars fans.
Especially convention fans.
Convention Star Wars fans, yes.
Yeah.
Boba Fett. That's strange. Does the other Boba Fett ever, big fan, does Jango Fett ever get to go to conventions? Or don't they want him? Do they just want Jeremy Bullock?
I assume they take anybody that they can get from the series.
Yeah, he was... I saw him when I was over in Atlanta, so he was at a convention there. I didn't see him in the fact that I went to talk to him, but I saw him sitting two tables away.
Who? Jango or Boba?
Jango Fett.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
Okay.
I'm sure he's a very interesting guy. Jeremy Bullock is the true convention whore.
Should we get a voice for that done?
Yeah, I think we should.
The convention hall.
Exactly. Yeah, it's a funny, because it's Holmes, it's a Holmes script, and because it's the classic Golden Pertwee era, which has to be reviled with virgin fans put to the altar and all that sort of thing. But it sort of has a sort of classic era, because I think it's the first with Suntarans as well. Mm-hmm. But I really think it is just feels a bit shoddy and pointless. I don't get the impression that, I never get the feeling that Pertwee's particularly into that one either.
No, I think the problem, I think there's three problems with it. I think there's probably the fact that they've had to start reshooting it, which we'll come on to in a minute. Or certainly, you know, they had to make a big change in the pre-production, so that could have had an impact on that. I think the most interesting parts are the parts with the Suntaran, the parts with David Akers' Iron-Gron and Blood Axe, and with Professor Rubish, and they're the most interesting characters. They Edward of Wessex and his Lady Eleanor are dull as dishwater, really. If you were like the third castle, would you really be that bothered if theirs got taken over? Because God, they're the dullest people on the planet, aren't they?
Absolutely.
I'm right behind Iron-Gron taking over Wessex. And you know, I'm usually quite I'm amused by villains. There's very few villains in Doctor Who that get me on side beyond the Master. So they are dullards.
Yeah, but did it get you on side by? Yeah, it gets you on side by default.
Yes,
because everyone else is just so truly tedious.
Yeah, exactly.
And simple. It's a very odd script given its Holmes, really, because there is so little character beyond Lynx, and you say Iron-Gron, although Iron-Gron's a fairly staple villain. I think that's where it suffers. I think Doctor Who is a show which is often very good because of this of the sort of character portrayal. That's when it's at its best. And if you lack those over four episodes, yeah.
I think Rubish was a fun one to throw on that character list. I found him an interesting a guy. I don't know. I just the fact that the Doctor kept trying to say, you know, we got to get you out of here. It's a dangerous situation, and he kept telling him, you know, forget that. This is science. You know, this is interesting. I want to stay. And I liked him. I felt he was more of like a Holmes kind of character, like usually his two comedic characters put into one, you know.
It was nice that he had some sort of little proactive things that he would do himself, if I recall, and correct me if I'm wrong, things like the glasses with the lens.
Yes.
You know, tiny things like that are quite nice, things which just sort of give him his own little space in the story.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. And certainly Lynx, Kevin Lindsay, I watching this story again made me realize just how mistreated the Suntarans are after probably the Suntaran experiment. You know, that they're just never quite the same again. They never really get used the same. And whereas here, I liked just the whole militaristic approach to him. I liked his thinking. I liked the character. I felt he was very, despite the fact that he was in a silly story, and certainly he was really enjoying the character, I thought he played the character straight, and I really enjoyed that. I liked how he actually seemed like a threat, and it just made me sad to see like what the Suntarans have become after what this guy created for them. I thought he did such a great job for it.
Yeah, I'm not its biggest fan, but I do appreciate Suntaran's stratagem has been a good run out for the Suntarans to kind of solidify their place in Doctor Who. But you know, since then, I think they've gone even worse in the wrong direction with the comical Strax, as I call
absolutely
it.
That's what I'm saying. Yeah.
Do you think?
I loved the Suntaran experiment in this one. That's what I'm saying. Those are the two big ones to me. Everything else. Sorry, James. Keep.
I was just gonna say, do you think it would have been better if Lynx had escaped? Do you know, have given it a certain maturity? Because I think you end up quite liking Lynx in his own way. And the fact that he sort of dies so almost needlessly at the very end.
He's a monster, isn't he? And it's 1974, so he has to die.
That's what I mean. But if he had just sort of shot off into the sky or disappeared and everything hadn't been destroyed, that would have sort of carried somehow. I think it would have given this story a bit more of its own identity.
It could have, but going by what we kind of know of the Suntarans, you know, you face battle, you win or you die. So if he escaped, then the outcome would have been that he would have come back in force and taken over the win, because you can't be bested. So I think honestly, not even just because it was 1974, I think he actually had to die, because if he didn't die, he would keep coming back to make sure he won.
And he's a clone, so it doesn't matter.
I tend to feel in a sort of weird way, it wouldn't be so much that you want him to come back. I'm not saying that's what you mean, Brian, but it's not so much that you'd want him to come back or that he has a special identity, but it had just felt, I don't know, a little more of a deeper story. And I don't know if he would definitely come back, because like a lot of people, or a lot of soldiers, a lot of wars, if they don't think something's consequential, then they don't tend to come back, because what you offer is nothing.
Well, I get that, but
not really a true battle.
The whole thing that they have with the whole Suntarans is honor. And if these nobodies bested him and he had to retreat, that is forfeighting your honor. So that's why
I wouldn't say he would come back to kind of regain. I mean, he's stuck there, so he's not retreating. It's just simply getting off again and heading back to his wars. It's not so much a retreat. I mean, the only other thing I would say, I think it's odd with Suntarans, is that they set them up as one of the only races in Doctor Who, apart from the Daleks, which time travel. And yeah, that is utterly forgot after Invasion of Time.
Yeah.
And that was always a bit weird.
Thing I noticed too.
Especially in the reintegrating them back into mythology with Davis's. The fact that they can time travel, you think would be a way to use
it's
them
not
differently.
Real time travel, is it? As the doctor explains, it's a matter transmitter that's been adjusted in some way. So the Suntarans aren't actually travelling through time as something that they do habitually. It's just it's the only way. It's a way that Lynx has developed to get the tools and the technology and the expertise that he needs to escape from where he is. If it was actual time travel, then he could just take himself and his pod into the future and not pinch anyone.
Yeah, but I mean,
but he took people from the future into the past, so that's got to still be actual
time. Yeah, but it's a time travel. It's not like they possess time travel technology. It's that he's adapted technology that he's got in order to grab those.
Yeah, but if you've got the potential,
like a
one
magnet.
Of your grunts, if one of your grunts has a potential to sort of generate time travel just to go and pick a few guys up to help you repair your ship, you've got to sort of say, well, they probably have got the capability if they chose to time travel. Especially if they're a clone race. It's not like he can be a particularly bright clone that the others aren't. It's just a bit of a mess in that sort of way.
This is actually one of those stories, too, where time traveling in any way probably just wasn't necessary. Because if the Suntarans had crashed on Earth currently, the modern day at the time, and needed their scientists to fix their ship to get out of there, that would have at least worked a little bit better.
Now, do you think there's a shopping list aspect to this?
Yeah, probably.
Then Barry Lett said to Robert Holmes, "I want a medieval castle, an alien, and some scientists from the future."
Yeah, it does feel a bit.
It does, doesn't it?
Potched together. And I think that's why it doesn't totally work.
Maybe Terence Dick said it.
Most likely.
I want an alien, some scientists from the future, and
yes.
That was a very poor impersonation of Terence Dix. And, you know, speech impediments aren't funny, as I've been learning this afternoon whilst watching Holy Flying Circus. Oh, yes, they are. Sorry. Now, April Walker. Do you know who April Walker is?
No.
Do you, James, know who April Walker is?
I will very shortly. So in a temporal sense, yes, I do.
Well, you probably do know. If you have watched Fawlty Towers, you have seen April Walker. She's in an episode of Fawlty Towers called The Wedding Party, in which Basil gets into all sorts of confusions with his guests and his wife, just like in every other episode of Fawlty Towers. Suspecting that a particular couple are having sex despite being unmarried and sharing a hotel room, because there was rules about those kind of things 40 years ago. And she was also the original Sarah Jane Smith. Now this came to light in 2012. Yeah. This came to light in 2012 in the Unit Files DVD release. There was a DVD extra which explained over the years, Liz Sladen knew who she'd replaced, but she never shared who it was because she thought it would be unfair to the actress concerned. And in the text commentary to Invasion of the Dinosaur, it is Invasion of the Dinosaurs even, it's revealed that it was April Walker who apparently, I think there's something else about this, I wonder if it's in Nothing at the End of the Lane, the same one that the Dark Dimension's in. I've certainly read it somewhere, so I'll put the correct source in the show notes, that John Pertwee was a little bit put out that the actress that replaced Katie Manning was kind of a tall, buxom lady rather than a small petite lady, so she was paid off, and part of her payoff, because obviously Doctor was a BBC production then, lots of other things were BBC productions, unlike these days where Doctor is a BBC Wales production and many other shows are in-house and many other shows are provided by external producers, production companies. She was then given several roles within the BBC in order to basically earn her keep for what she'd been paid for Doctor Who. So she went on to appear in Dad's Army, in Terry and June, as, quote, the attractive barmaid, unquote, in a Two Ronnie sketch, and in that particular episode of Fawlty Towers. So by now you should have already Googled her, chaps, to see what she looks like. I'm pretty sure James will have been.
I have done before. I just completely forgotten the name.
Yeah. So that was the original Sarah Jane who was cast before Liz Sladen, and John Pertwee felt that she wasn't right for the part, even though she'd been cast. Presumably Pertwee was, you know, away, I don't know, flying a rocket around Australia or skydiving from Telstar or something while she was being cast. Other kind of danger man pursuits are available.
Now, was that what you meant earlier when you said that they did reshoots? Like, did they actually shoot anything with
her? I'm not sure if they did shoot anything. They definitely did rehearsals.
Okay.
I'm pretty 90% certain they did rehearsals. Maybe they didn't shoot, but they certainly did rehearsals. So, you can see why he may have preferred having another small companion. But as we saw from the from Liz Sladen's memoirs, she didn't get on with him that well. So maybe it was all in vain for old Pertwee. Maybe that's why he decided to leave.
Well, wasn't part of that too that he just didn't like a leading lady that was taller than him or as tall as him?
Yeah, I think that was why he preferred a young petite. Co-star. Yeah.
I don't, you know, it's a shame because I don't know if I know any of April's work, but I mean, I love Liz Sladen, you know, so it's like one of those things where it's a sad story to hear, but we got somebody brilliant out of it. You know, someone who, you know, I know is generally hailed this way, but I certainly agree with it. Who's the best classic companion, who's the best companion still, actually, I feel to this day, just period. Mm-hmm. So it's very interesting. I'd be very curious to see more of her work, see what she's like as an actress, to be honest.
Well, I mean, you probably won't have realised, but the other shows, I mean, they're all comedies. Dad's Army, Terry and June, Fawlty Towers, you will know is a comedy, and the Two Ronnies. Two Ronnies is a, like, two comedians, well, two comedy actors, really. They weren't really comedians. Dad's Army is a...
Two actors.
Yeah. Dad's Army is a... That's a group of actors basically doing comedy. It's a group piece. It's not the word I'm looking for, but it's gonna have
to. How many troupe?
No, they're not a troupe. No, they are. I mean, they are a troupe in one sense because it's about basically during the war in the UK. Because all the young men went off to went off into the army, there was only old men left and the infirm and whatever to defend the country. So Dad's Army is about a troupe of soldiers who are mainly, you know, veterans and the infirm, and it was on TV for like 15 years. And Terry and June, which is a kind of a man and woman two-hander with lots of cross pollination of guest actors between all of those shows. Actually, just on a kind of a BBC roundabout of actors getting jobs in successive shows. It's quite amusing if you watch a few BBC comedies from those days, and you just spot the same faces popping up again and again and again, and also in Doctor Who from time to time as well. So that's who April Walker was, and her relationship with Doctor Who didn't actually happen, but it might have done in a parallel universe. It might have happened.
Mm.
Yes, indeed, and she was in her 30s as well.
You know, I was just looking at a link that was put on the Casterbris website in response to one of our comments, and it took me to another companion. I think it's a Times piece, Telegraph piece, on Carolyn Ford. And this really does bug me. Is the name of the piece is, and you probably won't be surprised, Doctor Who, It Destroyed My Acting Career. And I can appreciate why Carolyn Ford feels this, but I still always find it a very negative and, dare I say, a little presumptuous. Because, you know, prior to Doctor Who, while, you know, she was doing well, she was, as has been noted, you know, a jobbing actress. She was doing different roles. And, you know, there's never any specific indication that Doctor Who actually inhibited her career, or her career might have not gone any further anyway. Mm. You know, Doctor Who obviously created a situation which propelled her into pop culture at the time. And therefore, when you look at it retrospectively after that, you can say how Doctor Who hindered from that level where she was from going any further or at the same level.
Yeah.
But it does, you know, I always find those articles very frustrating, because you sometimes think, you know, was Doctor Who actually... You don't know, Doctor Who could have been the best thing you ever did, and it's certainly keeping you working now. Are you absolutely certain that your career would have gone in a better, definitively better direction? Because acting is such a hard career as it is, if you hadn't had it. Do you see what I mean? It's a sort of frustrating article to read, because not because I'm trying to be apologetic to Doctor Who, or even trying to say I know better than she does, because she knows her career far better than I do. But it just kind of feels like, can you be sure? Because it's such an unusual situation when you're in any show which takes you into beyond television, beyond acting, into celebrity sphere of pop stars, basically. It's pop star sphere, which is where she was.
It is a tough thing to say, because all you can actually go by is what actually happened. She was in Doctor Who, and then the career didn't necessarily take off. But what we don't see is, was she ever told, look, you're too well known from that show, or was it ever hinted at, or anything? But like, we'll never see the other side simply because she was in Doctor Who. So like, I agree with what you're saying. I think we'll never see whether she
went for those same roles that she was perhaps turned down to because of turned down from Doctor Who. Would she have still got them if she hadn't? And would she have had the profile? That's the difficult thing. Is I don't know. I think
it's interesting when you look at somebody like Peter Davison, who still had a very successful career. You know, maybe he hasn't like shot up to be, you know, one of the biggest A-list or actors, but he's had a very interesting career, and he certainly is a very talented actor. You know, so I think it might also be part of it. If you can give them what they want during an audition, maybe you're not necessarily as typecast as you think you are. Not to downplay, I feel bad saying that about Carolyn Ford. I'm not trying to say that about her. I'm just saying, like, using Peter as an example, I guess I should say.
I mean, I imagine it's harder if you're a woman, because women roles are so much more classified by your age group than perhaps even your ability to act. While, you know, Peter, I imagine, in some respects, would have an easier time, because there's a more variety of different sort of roles for a man than there is probably for a woman. And so perhaps it's easier as an actor, a good actor, to actually find roles, while for a woman it's probably harder. But again, that's, and even though she's always said, and I totally agree with her, that her role in Doctor Who never lived up to its potential. Don't know. I just sometimes feel, is it definitely the show that hindered your career, or did the show take you into an area of acting that so few people, whether you can sustain that level or even keep, you know, even these days, you know, you look at Tennant, you look at Eccleston, you look at Smith, and they're all doing good things, but nothing compares to the profile that Doctor Who gives you. Even though they are things which I'm sure they're all happy, especially maybe Christopher, he's probably happier doing, but it is such an unusual show, it must be very hard to sort of quantify it in terms of career. Anyway, sorry.
It's certainly different now, though, because it's more of a high-profile show, so being in that is actually a little bit more status than it used to be. I totally agree with you, though. You made a very interesting point with Susan, not letting her character live up to the potential, because I've always said this, that in the pilot episode, they make her such an interesting character. Yeah. She's so smart. She's so independent, it seems, and very interesting take, certainly for a character of the era. And then they quickly just put her into the teenage screamer role where they need somebody to be afraid and to be rescued. And it's sad because they did something so cool, especially I just watched The Sensorites. And in there, I mean, anybody who ever wants to doubt, is she really Gallifreyan, human, whatever, in there she describes Gallifrey. She talks about being home and wanting to see her home and hers and the doctor's home, you know? So it's like, she's Gallifreyan. And rather than like show that maybe their children are a little bit different than ours, and certainly she's far more intelligent, they just told us, no, she's just still a 16-year-old kid just like Earth. And I always found that so sad. And she did well in the beginning. She did really well playing that interesting kid. Like you actually were curious, like, what the heck's going on? Why is this kid so smart? Why does this kid think the things that she thinks, you know?
Well, that's saying that's totally lost as it goes on. Absolutely. You totally lose that.
Back to the Time Warrior. When we discussed Time Lash, we did some sort of rating system, didn't we?
Oh, yeah.
What was it we did again? I don't remember. How did we rate it? Did we give it some sort of... Is it
Lashes?
did we just say that it live up to the hype?
Yeah, whether it was deserved of its place in the doldrums of Doctor Who. What were you laughing at?
It's just like, does it deserve its place? You tend to think of it as sort of places in a hierarchy. Where does it deserve its place as being, you know, right at the bottom, as you continue to say, in the basement.
In the basement.
It's not even on the basement, is it? It sort of sits like manacled outside the Doctor Who tent for people to laugh and kick as they walk in.
But as we kind of established, it isn't quite as bad as that. It's not perfect.
Absolutely not.
So the Time Warrior is, you know, it's considered a kind of a middling and, you know, a middle ranking episode. It has key introductions in the Sontarans and Sarah Jane Smith, but
and Sarah Jane, yeah.
Yep, as I said, is there a time discrepancy?
Yeah, I didn't know you were going to say it as well.
Oh, okay, well, that's my job. So how do you feel? Do you feel it deserves its place there? Do you think maybe it actually deserves to be further down the appreciative rankings or higher up, Brian?
Okay.
You know, for me, I wasn't aware that it had a kind of like middle ground. I didn't know one way or the other with the story, because it was, I did find out, by the way, it was not in the box set that I said it was in. So I had to have seen it sooner than I thought, but it still would have been on VHS, because I don't think that was one that I ever saw aired on PBS. But anyway, because of that, I just never really looked into it. I never really was aware that some people didn't like it. Some people loved it. Some people thought, meh, whatever. But watching it again, there were a lot of enjoyable aspects to it, and then there were other aspects to it that, like you had pointed out, both of you had pointed out, that just weren't that perfect or could have been better. For me, I don't know what it is, but the whole medieval era is just something that I generally am not that into, and I usually say I can take it for a time travel story, and that's about it. But with this story, I have to agree that it certainly would have been better set in a different era. So I enjoyed it. I still like it. I don't think it's the most fantastic story, but I also wouldn't call it one of the worst. So I think the middle ground area is pretty well deserved for the story, if that's really where it is placed.
Okay. I think about medieval is a lot of what people think of being as medieval is actually kind of the imprint of French Romanticism. It really, really irritates a lot of historians that what people think of being medieval isn't actually medieval. I just thought I'd just introduce that to you. And also, just something that I recalled from watching the stunt scene, the fight scene with John Pertwee in the courtyard. It occurs to me that's not John Pertwee, it's Terry Walsh, isn't it? There's no way that's John Pertwee
I noticed
in the long
that too.
Shots. Yeah.
Mm.
Yeah.
I also found it interesting that the bulk of that fight scene was in long shots.
Yeah, I think that's why.
That's not really done. That was rather than doing it like all the close-ups of any sort, it was pretty much just watching an entire somebody observing the fight scene.
Yeah, yeah.
Kind of aspect.
Yeah. I wonder if they did any maybe they did some close-ups and decided it was too obvious it wasn't John Pertwee, or maybe they just didn't turn out. So James, how do you feel about the Time Warrior ranking wise?
It's slow, derivative. Sarah Jane is frustrating in it. She's not actually particularly enjoyable to watch. Her position and the interrogation with all the other characters is just barely panto-esque. It almost feels like watching an episode of Rainbow, which I know won't help Brian there, but you know what I mean.
Yes.
Come on, people. Get it right. I don't know. So, no, I'd give it a sort of a 5.
Out of 5?
If we're rating it.
Out of 10?
Yes, they are. I've been watching some.
Yeah. What are you rating out of? Out of 10?
Yeah.
Okay. You sure?
44. 5 out of 40. No, okay. 21. 13.
5 out of 10, then.
12.
So you're kind of leaving it where it is. I think having watched it again, I don't really think my opinion has possibly gone down slightly.
Good.
Of the Time Warrior. It has some entertaining moments. As I say, Iron Gron and Blood Axe are fun. Rubish is fun. The Brigadier might as well not be in it. Might as well just have Benton in or Yates. Well, not Yates. Yates. Yeah, no, Yates could have been in, couldn't he? Could he? Yeah. No.
No.
At that stage, no.
No, not by then.
No. Benton could have done the job. Just leave Courtney on stage or whatever he was doing that season. Not trouble him. Not even bother with that. It's a bit of a hodgepodge in places, isn't it, as we've established. And I do feel it could have just been done with being tight. But as I say, there may have been mitigating circumstances in the production that caused those kind of problems. But the Wessex is a dull as dishwater, and I'd have gladly joined Bloodaxe's army to vanquish the pale-skinned old man and his barmy wife, quite frankly.
And it's also got those horrible little ways of defeating his men, and I don't know, it does feel like it's almost like a children's show again.
Well, he's only got an army of 5 as well, hasn't he?
Oh, that as well. And the way that Sarah addresses them as well, you know, talks down to them as if they're sort of simple idiots, which
well,
I suppose they are.
Of course they're simple idiots. They're medieval.
They're from the past. You know, yeah, exactly.
They were too stupid to even build castles. Oh, hold on.
Yeah, exactly. And that's how it feels. It just feels derivative on every level. In fact, I'm lowering my score to 4 out of 44 now, because it's just... It is just terrible. I mean, Lynx is good in it, yeah. Suntarans is a good idea. But that's about it for me, I'm sorry. The rest of it is just boring.
Yeah, so if I was to give it a numerical score out of 10, as James McLean did previously, I'd probably give it 3 or 4.
3 or 4, that's fair enough.
Yeah. Okay, so we're not going to do recommendations this week, because our recommendation is that you watch The Time Warrior and throw your comments at us on the show notes page, dear listener. And obviously you can listen to us... if you're listening to us on iTunes, then you maybe, if you have something to say, maybe...
you do realise we've had two listeners ask for a specific invasion this week.
Have we?
Sorry, did I say invasion?
Yes.
I meant, two listeners.
Really?
You said, yeah.
The invasion. We only have one recommendation this week, and that is The Time Warrior, so...
Well, you know,
invasion podcast?
Yeah. I am suggesting that our podcast has been invaded by people who want to suggest that we should recommend invasion. And I'd like to pick you up on that. You'd rather recommend The Time Warrior.
Well, we recommended the time lash over anything else last time we did a
only because we didn't mention the invasion.
I think we did actually.
Well, I don't, maybe, but it
probably
wasn't possibly. I don't know. usually. But yeah, they said there was a reason as well.
Our recommendation this week is that you watch The Time Warrior and offer your thoughts. If you would like to watch The Invasion, we are in no position to stop you. And, you know, it's...
Why?
You should watch The Invasion.
I just have this lovely warm feeling that there's out, because we do have more than one listener. We have, you know, several thousand.
It's surprising for some reason. But
maybe someone out there does take our recommendation seriously, and each week has to watch The Invasion because of it, because we recommend it.
Oh my god,
so cool.
Can you imagine the fan that we would create, like the anger and the hatred they would have for us if they watched that story every week just because we suggested it? They at one point in their lives they loved that story, and right now they're like twitching as they sit in their chair and watch it, looking up ways to find us on the internet.
So hi to you, that listener.
Oh, God.
And we will return next week.
James, I have a feeling it's Christian.
What's me?
Every time James recommends it, I think you watch The Invasion.
No, I don't. No,
I wish you did. That'd be so good.
No, it's not me. So, as I was saying, dear listener, we'll be back next time with some more Doctor Who related chit chat and chin rubbing and Mickey taking. And maybe even something more substantial. Perhaps even a guest. But until next time, it's a goodbye from us. And them. And me.
And The Invasion.
Goodbye.
Casterbellus.com has to be my favorite website in the cosmos. Would you like a jelly, baby?